Welcome to the beginning of the holiday season. This is Take 5 with Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
All right, Cindy. So what's the longest you ever traveled home to Thanksgiving to your mother's house when you were a kid?
Probably when I was in culinary school in New York, going to the Culinary Institute of America. My parents were living in Charleston, South Carolina. So that was a pretty long trip and absolutely worth it because, you know, those memories and just getting to be with family, especially when you're away at school and, you know, seeing everybody in the family. Charleston was a great place to celebrate. The weather was always so gorgeous that time of the year. And we could head out to the beach if we wanted to and get some great oysters. And, you know, it's just all kinds of fun celebrations happen in Charleston around that time of the year.
It's an interesting thing. Thanksgiving, I always have liked working Thanksgiving, which is sort of an odd thing. But I've always enjoyed it because you see people, it's that holiday where they're really, the achievement of it is having a big meal with all the people that you're close to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no stress in anything other than, you know, are you going to destroy the turkey this year, right?
Right. Well, I think that's a great thing for us in the kitchen is to provide people with what feels like food, you know, that you're having Thanksgiving at home. We do side dishes just like you would have at home at Charleston. And
Well, I mean, the Thanksgiving at home, maybe, you know, mom's mashed potatoes, you love mom, but maybe her mashed potatoes are not fantastic.
Right, so we're going to help you make sure that doesn't happen this year.
And you love mom, but she might have assassinated the frozen turkey that she got.
Or she might have put marshmallows on the sweet potatoes and maybe you don't really like them that way. Or she made green bean casserole.
God bless America.
Yeah, but or maybe your mom is a great cook, I hope so, or your father or whoever's doing the cooking. But I think a couple of tips about, you know, executing some of the food dishes, traditional dishes, and yeah, you know, there's some definite tricks and things to make it easier for everyone.
I always think of whether it's Thanksgiving or any kind of, people are coming to the house. And I always think of things in segments, you know, because you have that sort of, you have some kind of reception time, even if it's as relaxed as just immediate family, some kind of reception time. And that's, you know, making people feel welcome. That whole, you know, whatever that, it's funny. Because there are always three segments. There's always before the meal, making people relaxed, getting to the table and sitting at the table, and then what you do afterwards.
Right.
And besides watching all the football, which I know you love.
Well, and also with Thanksgiving, you're not eating in courses. You know, you're preparing a whole lot of food that you pretty traditionally eat all at once.
So if you're coming in from culinary school in New York, and
mm-hmm.
you're traveling all the way down south.
Mm-hmm.
And in your perfect world, you know, you wish mom had on what? Something hot.
Absolutely.
You wish you had a glass of something fun.
Yeah.
And you want a little unwinding time with the people that you care about, right?
Absolutely. And I think those smells, the way that, you know, I'm already anticipating, I'm already getting hungry, you know, on the drive, getting close to home, because I know her house is going to smell so good. And, you know, if there's some cider on the stove with mulling spices in it, and that's something everyone can have that. And it can sit on there for, you know, on very low heat for hours, you know, so everyone can kind of go over and help themselves. I think when things, you know, when everyone can kind of contribute and it can be made easy for people to just help themselves, I think it really helps out the person that's actually doing the cooking.
So let's put together a quick, you know, like everyone's coming from somewhere else. You want to have things out for people, make them feel good, make things smelling good. So you set cider on the stove.
Mm-hmm.
One.
I also would like to have a little bit of a sort of a pre-dinner cheese out. I think something like a soft goat cheese or a very mild goat cheese that's perhaps marinated in extra virgin olive oil and a little bit of fresh pepper, and you have crackers or toast points or fresh bread out for that. You know, that's something that is okay for it to sit out for an hour or two. So you could have things like that sitting around, or bowls of walnuts or bowls of apples and pears where people can just grab something. You know, they're already washed, they're ready to go, they're not cut, but you can just grab them and snack on those while you're standing around talking or sitting around watching a game.
I always think that you get into November and you're talking prime oyster time. That's what I wish was always kind of like, you know, if you're coming in the house,
mm-hmm.
you know, just sitting out. Well, you know, there's, you know, that I'd be happy to go in the kitchen and shuck oysters and
exactly.
and drink champagne for the next hour while dinner got put together.
And I think that is a great start. You know, we have wonderful local oysters where you can go ahead and get some from the southern part of our country or from the northeast or even from the west coast.
So maybe give me three different oysters that are really interesting. Maybe it's to get a box of or a couple dozen
okay.
of or whatever it might be that you could shuck and start laying out when people come in the door.
Malpecs are great. Blue points are amazing if you can find them. And, you know, even oysters, again, we have what we call locals that are local oysters and an original name. And, of course, oysters from down south. Yeah. I think those would be great choices. But really, you know, if you're here, you might as well buy some local oysters. And, you know, it's that idea that you can just stand around the table and someone can start shucking, or you can already have them shucked and laid out on ice and have all your condiments, you know, a little bit of fresh lemon. I know a lot of people like Tabasco with their oysters. I love mignonette, which is what the French people serve, which is red wine vinegar and shallots and crushed black pepper. And that's so refreshing. That's one of my favorites. And if you really want to, you know,
But you don't like bathe the oyster in that. You put just like a little drop.
Oh, definitely.
Sort of like seasoned vinegar.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can just have bowls of these things out and allow people to help themselves. I would just have the oyster shucked and out. And then another really elegant way to serve oysters is if you could afford to do this, would be to have a little bit of caviar with them, which is just, I mean, that's very fancy, but it's such a treat. So, you know.
I think my favorite garnish for oysters, my favorite sauce for oysters, is known as champagne. Just a cold, salty, clean oyster with nice and frothy and light and clean mineralized champagne, like Paul Roger's non-vintage bottling, Delamotte's non-vintage bottling, some of the pretty Chardonnay-based wines that are sort of moussey and light.
Mm-hmm.
They're also excellent sparkling wines from other places in the world, but it's one of those things, it's the holidays, so, you know, be pretty nice to welcome people in the beginning with that. What else do you like with champagne that would be nice to walk into the house to...
Gougère would also be nice.
So how about a recipe for gougères?
All right. Gougère, in order to make it, you would need a cup of milk, and whole milk, please, 6.5 tablespoons of unsalted butter, about a teaspoon of kosher salt, 1.25 cups of all-purpose flour, 4 whole eggs, and 4 ounces of grated Gruyere cheese. I would do a pinch of cayenne and a pinch of freshly ground black pepper. That's up to you. And, you know, the process is, it's very simple and pretty quick to make, but you have to pay attention to what you're doing. So you bring the milk up to a boil with the butter and the salt in it. And once it comes up to a boil, you turn it down and you immediately shake all the flour into the pot. Now, of course, this is in a heavy bottom pot on the stove that you're doing this. And when you put the flour in, you can start with a whisk and then move to a wooden spoon or some sort of thing like that, and you want to kind of beat it up, the process of working the gluten and the starches in the flour. And that you can have on low heat for just about 3 to 4 minutes. You need some of that moisture to evaporate out in the form of steam. So while you're moving it around, obviously you want it on very low heat. You don't actually want to brown it in any way. And then take it off the heat. You can still leave it in the pot, and it would be a sauce pot that you're using.
So
by the way, you need a high-sided pot for this.
What is the texture of the substance like at this point?
It actually forms a big ball, basically.
So it's kind of a pasty ball.
Mm-hmm. And it pulls away. You can see it pulling away from the sides of the pan when you add all that flour at one time. Mm-hmm. And you'll see it coat the bottom of the pan a tiny bit, and that's okay. You just want to make sure your heat's very, very low. So once you take it off the stove, you're going to add the eggs, and you add them absolutely one at a time. They're not whisked. They're just whole eggs. Add them one at a time. And as you add them, you beat with that wooden spoon the egg into that. And you're going to, if you've never made it before, it's kind of weird. It's kind of really, it takes a while for it to absorb the egg, especially the white. So beat it up pretty well and then add the next egg, then add the next egg, and then add the fourth egg. And then just add half of your Gruyere cheese. So that would be 2 ounces of Gruyere. The spices could go in from the very beginning. Actually, I should have said that. So salt, freshly ground black pepper, and cayenne I would have put in with the flour, actually. Mm-hmm. And you're off the heat. And at this point, once you've added the Gruyere, you're ready to go into a pastry bag, typically an open tip, which means that the tip is
so it's not some it's not some decorating tip,
right? You don't need a star tip, what we call a star tip, and you just pipe them out in little kind of mounds, if you will, on preferably on a silpat. You could do it on parchment paper or wax paper if you had to.
So some kind of a nonstick surface for the sheet pan that you're going to go on to.
Exactly.
People think of it as a cookie sheet or a...
Exactly. Yeah. And about 400 degrees. Again, we do it in a convection oven at 400. And you want to rotate the pan halfway through the baking process. It can take up to, you know, 12, 14 minutes. It kind of depends. All of our ovens are different. And you do want them to become golden on the outside. About halfway through that cooking process, I do like to add a little bit of freshly grated Gruyere to the top of them. So I try not to pull them out of the oven. I don't want to stop that rising process that they're in at that moment. Very quickly, I would, you know, pull the sheet towards me, sprinkle a little bit of Gruyere on them, and then put it right back in and finish the baking process.
Yeah, these are marvelous little pastries that are you know, not sweet, but it's a mm-hmm. it's a like a puff ball with a little cheesy crusty exterior.
Oh, they're so good.
That sort of thing, as a contrast for those salty oysters, both are fantastic with champagne.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be the nicest thing to come in the house too, I think.
Absolutely. Well,
you have a giant
so
meal coming, but yeah, they smell great.
They smell
and
so good.
One thing is hot, one thing is cold, and
right.
And both want that wine.
Well, and I will tell you, once you master this recipe,
this is how you make it every time.
Yeah, exactly. You'll make them all the time because you'll crave them, and everybody loves them. And also, you're basically also now understanding how to make profiteroles, which is a classic French pastry. The because the pastry rises, we typically would cut them in half and add ice cream and hot chocolate sauce. Of course, you would skip the Gruyere cheese and add a little bit of sugar to the recipe.
I'm going to bother you for profiterole preparations at Christmas time.
Okay, sounds good.
You know, besides the profiteroles and the oyster, the one thing that just occurred to me, coming home on that cold day, Charleston, you're coming home, it's not a cold day in November. But here right now, there's a chill in the air. When you come in the house, don't you wish you could get a little bit of soup, something to warm you up from the inside?
Absolutely.
That's the one other thing that I really wish. So what at this time of the year, what are the things that you love to make that are not going to offend the pumpkin pie that I have to have at the end?
Sweet potato soup would be, and also if you're going to make sweet potatoes, it's just a second use of something you already have in your refrigerator. And sweet potatoes are high in starch, so that comes up pretty quickly. A little bit of, you could always put some sort of bacon, or you could add chestnuts to it, a little bit of shallot, onion, a little bit of cream, and some wonderful spices, cinnamon, nutmeg, a little bit of cayenne again. So a pumpkin soup, you could always do oyster stew, again, utilizing something that you already have in your house.
The cauliflower this time of the year is so good.
Mm-hmm.
You make a cauliflower soup that's spectacular.
And it's so light and pretty in your mouth. I mean, it's just sort of almost mousse-like in texture. So cauliflower with a little bit of cream, and that absolutely, I do put nutmeg in, a little black pepper, salt, and maybe one potato just to give it a little bit of body, one Yukon Gold potato.
Oh, that sounds like a nice way to...
And in an espresso cup, you know, serving it around in little espresso cups.
So not too much, not fill you up too much.
And also it's easy. You know, a guest can stand there and just drink right out of that. You don't need a spoon, so it's... unless
you're being casual and just do a little coffee mugs
mm-hmm.
or something. Or,
exactly.
Yeah, an easy something.
Absolutely.
Well, when we come back, we're going to get into the real part of Thanksgiving dinner. We're going to talk turkey.
Welcome back to Take Five. I'm Chef Cindy Wolf.
And I'm Tony Foreman. And I'm excited about turkey.
We
live in a world of disappointing turkey, Cindy.
I can't wait to tell you how to make a turkey that you're going to think might... I think it's easier. It's cool because you start the day ahead of Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's smart. The two things that always happen. One, turkey's dry.
Right.
And two, everything's cold when it gets to the table.
Do we know why it's dry? Yes, it has a low fat content.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just almost no fat on a bird like that. So you really have to keep it.
You just wrap the entire bird in bacon.
Well, there's that. Or some people deep fry it. That sounds like a dangerous but fun experience. But I've never done that.
Yeah, the shame is it's a bird with a delicate flavor. It's like, you know, it's one of those holy grails of cooking. It's like mm-hmm. roasting a chicken properly. If you
yes,
can do it properly,
yeah.
It's delicate, it's rich, it's juicy. You know, the thing is with the turkey, it's the issues are amplified. The leg meat is even stronger,
mm-hmm.
right? And the breast is even, you know, it's as delicate as a chicken. So,
mm-hmm. Well, what I would suggest doing is getting your turkey in. Well, obviously, wash it very well. This is the day before Thanksgiving. Cut the legs off of the bird. Leave the wings, everything else, on the body or the carcass of the turkey. And season the breast inside and out, salt and pepper. Put anything you want in there that you like. Fresh thyme in the cavity, rosemary in the cavity. Make a little marinade with thyme and rosemary, which would be just lightly chopping the fresh herbs, a little bit of butter. I also like to slide butter underneath the skin. I also sometimes put herbs underneath the skin. I certainly put salt underneath the skin.
Let me back you up one second. Okay, so you've taken the legs, the entire entirety of each of the two legs off of the carcass.
Right, and put them aside.
Right, and you put them aside because you're going to deal with them separately.
I am.
You're going to cook them separately.
I am.
The breast you're leaving on the rest of the carcass along with the wings.
Yes.
And then the breast you're doctoring with a little butter under the skin, herbs under the skin, seasoning inside and out of the carcass,
mm-hmm.
right? Salt and pepper, that kind of thing.
And I'm going to roast it at low heat, not too low, but, you know, probably right around 300 degrees and allow it to, you know, cook properly. And I cook it just about to medium, maybe a touch under medium, so that it's still a little bit translucent right at the body of the bird.
So it's not where you can eat it. It's not 165 degrees plus.
No, it's probably about 120 degrees.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to, you know, put that aside, let it rest for a bit after it comes out of the oven.
And then you're going to just put that in the refrigerator, yeah?
And actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to take those breasts off the carcass. And I'm going to wrap them up properly. Actually, I usually put them in foil and put them in my refrigerator.
And you're leaving them like with, you know, season them one more time.
I do season them one more time.
One more time. Maybe
just
give them
salt and pepper.
Baste them a little bit of butter or whatever.
And put them in the foil.
And put them in the refrigerator. And put them in the fridge.
Okay, you're done with that for now, for today.
Yeah. Now, but then you have the carcass.
You're going to put the carcass back in the oven and brown it the rest of the way. You don't want it to get too brown.
Do you raise the heat a little bit in the oven to do
that?
No,
I don't actually. I don't get it too hot in there. So it's 350 degrees is fine. And you want it to just brown a little bit where the breast was.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to make stock. Okay, now you're going to be making a much better sauce.
So you cut up that carcass to make the stock, to reduce it, to make the sauce.
Exactly. And I deglaze that pan, that roasting pan as well, which most people, that's typically how I think they make their kind of gravy sauce, is by deglazing that turkey pan. Well, I'm going to deglaze that turkey pan because I want all that amazing flavor off the bottom of it. I'm also going to have these wonderful bones that I'm going to break up as best as I can into relatively small, you know, probably 4-inch, 6-inch pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to put that in a pot with carrot, celery, onion,
so pretty,
small dice.
Pretty good sized stock pot.
Yeah.
It holds probably, 2 gallons of water, 3 gallons of water.
Right. And you want the liquid to be probably about 6 inches above the amount of bones that you have. Cold water, you're doing, I think I just said a small dice, but a large dice of carrot, celery, and onion. And you can put a little bit of like 2 bay leaves, maybe 10 black peppercorns, and a pinch of dried thyme. And that cold water, bring it up to a boil. The moment it comes up to a boil, turn it down to the lowest simmer and let it cook for probably 2 hours. It doesn't have to go that long, but you will end up with a really pretty turkey stock. And then you strain it and let the fat rise to the top as it sits on your counter, and skim that fat off. I would actually reserve the fat and keep it for something else.
So you're pouring the liquid out of the pot after it's cooked a couple of hours and has a little color to it, and,
mm-hmm.
and you can smell the aroma of it, right?
Oh, it's
gorgeous. You're pouring it out through a sieve or something so that you only have the clear stock.
Right.
And the bit of fat that's in that pot that's gone into another vessel, right?
Yeah, and I'd like to make one other thing. The wings from that bird, if you don't need them, I would put them in with that stock because that will actually give you a little bit more meat because otherwise you pretty well have just bones there.
So you have a little more protein in the stock itself.
Exactly. You'll get better flavor out of your stock if you put those browned wings in as well.
Mm-hmm.
And some people like to eat them, so you may not want to put them to your stock, but I would highly suggest it. And so once you've strained it, and you've let it settle on the counter, and the fat has come to the top, you've skimmed that off, now you're going to reduce it.
So you have that clear stock, fat is removed.
Mm-hmm. And you will not be able to reduce it to sauce consistency. There's no way. There's not enough gelatin and turkey bones for you to do that, which is why people make gravy. So once you get that stock to where you think the flavor is really, really great, which maybe you reduce it by, almost 70%, then you can add a little bit of roux, which is you melt, it's 1-to-1 ratio. So let's say 2 ounces of butter and 2 ounces of flour. What you do is you melt your butter very delicately on the stove. You don't want it to get too hot or you certainly don't want it to brown. And you whisk in your flour and you set that aside. You let that cool down. You have to add cold roux to hot stock.
When you're making the roux, you've got to actually cook it a little bit, though, right?
Yeah. You can flip it around in the pan. You'll notice it when you're making a roux that it looks like wet sand at low tide, and it smells a little nutty as you're cooking it. You can cook, really, you need a blonde roux for this, so a blonde roux is the first stage of making a roux, so probably you basically cook it for about five minutes on the stove.
If you never made one and you were tasting it, Well, if it was not done yet, what would it taste like?
Raw flour, which is why you really need to cook it a little bit. And please don't taste it because you'll burn your mouth. Please don't taste it while you're making it.
I know someone will. So.
Oh, gosh, don't. But so that stock needs to be at a boil when you add the roux to it. And again, the roux needs to be cold. So you just slip it in the refrigerator for, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And then you kind of crumble it into your stock, whisk, whisk away. I mean, rapidly whisking.
So while the stock is hot and boiling away.
Yeah, add the roux. And then you have to cook a roux out for 30 minutes. Again, that's getting that kind of raw flour flavor out of there. And it also does its job. It thickens your stock while it's cooking. And of course, your stock does reduce a little bit over that 30-minute time. And then after it's done, strain it through a fine sieve. And now your sauce is ready for Thanksgiving as well.
There's a proper gravy.
Yeah, it's a fantastic sauce, actually. And so now you have a good sauce that's already ready to go for Thanksgiving Day. Your turkey breast, you're actually going to, on Thanksgiving Day, either put in the oven in the foil, or if you have a grill, I would just grill it. Which is great.
So grill it to get it to finish to that 165, 170 range.
Right. Now you're getting a little smoke into your turkey, which is really great. So, and again, you can baste it again with a little bit of fresh rosemary, maybe even extra virgin olive oil at that point, and re-season it as you're grilling it. But that's a great way. It gets it out of your kitchen. You know, it gets you onto another piece of cooking equipment so that, you know, your stove is going to be just packed with all this food and your oven's going to be full. So if you have the luxury of having a grill, it's a great solution.
All right, so we have the sauce. Mm-hmm. You have your grilled turkey breast mm-hmm. that you're probably resting. But didn't you do something with the legs the day before also?
Right. So we have to I confit the legs. Now, you could roast them, but I really, really suggest confiting them, which is the idea of immersing them in fat and cooking them very, very slowly at a low temperature. So I, season them with salt and pepper, and I cook them in butter. So, and frankly, because we love sage at this time of the year, I would either put a couple of leaves of fresh sage in the butter, along with peppercorns and bay leaf and a little bit of salt, or I might put rosemary in there.
So I'm trying to picture. So you have like a huge sort of casserole dish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Filled with melted butter?
Yes.
How hot is that when you put the turkey legs in?
It's just melted. It's not bubbling. You don't want it to bubble ever. You don't want the butter to get that hot, and you definitely don't, when you do go to cook the confit, you want to cook it about 180 degrees in the oven. So again, you're working with a vessel that's full of hot fat. Please be very, very careful handling it. It can be a bit of a mess if you're not very careful, and it can certainly burn you. But yeah, your turkey leg is immersed in butter with some seasonings in it, and probably takes about 2.5 hours to confit it.
Do you do anything to marinate or season the turkey legs before mm-hmm. they go in the butter?
Mm-hmm. Salt, pepper, and again, I would just put some seasoning in the butter as well. So that rosemary or sage or bay leaf, peppercorn, all of the above, you could do that. And so cook it very, very slowly at that low heat, and once it's falling off the bone, you know you've finished it. And then I typically...
Not falling apart, but like if you touch it, then you can tell it's just going to pull right off the bone.
Right, right. And then I typically let it cool down in the fat and pull it back out, the whole leg out, and pull the meat off the bone, discard the bone, discard the skin, discard anything that's not desirable, and then put the nice pieces of turkey leg meat back in the butter so it's ready for Thanksgiving.
So you're just kind of holding it warm in that.
Yes, and actually I would strain that butter before I put the leg meat back in. You want to get the peppercorns and the bay leaf and everything out of there, kind of clean that butter up, and then put the picked leg meat back in. And I would try and leave those pieces in the biggest pieces I could.
So when you're ready to serve your turkey, you have your gravy, your sauce, hot on the stove.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The breast has come off the grill. And that probably took, what, 20, 30 minutes?
Not even. Honestly, it's probably
to go up in
10
temperature.
Or 12. It's, well, maybe 15 by the time it's nice and hot. But yeah.
So you get the two big sides of the turkey breast. And the confit meat is something you've already warmed back up on the... Mm-hmm.
In the oven or on the stove. That's a great thing about it. Now you can do it either way. And honestly, because that butter
is going to
hold temperature.
Well, you want to be on the range top most likely because you're going to have other things
in the
oven.
And that butter is going to hold temperature. Once you do warm it, you can actually pull it up and just sit it in like the middle of your stove somewhere that's warm because it'll just keep the turkey leg meat warm.
Yeah. So when you go to serve it, you just strain that, right?
Exactly. So. Yeah, obviously. Yeah,
and place it on the platter.
Right. And, you know, that's so now we have turkey breast that's been cooked. You know, the confit is ready to go and your sauce is ready to go. I mean, it just makes it so much easier on the day. Because, you know, you have to do things like make potato puree to order, you know, mashed potatoes, whatever you want to call them. And
well, how if that's the critical thing, then what are the other side dishes that you that you suggest? What are the quick, you know,
Brussels sprouts?
Reasonable.
I think. Well, do you think we'll still be getting local Brussels sprouts?
Yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
so
yeah.
Until they're delicious.
Usually until first week is December, but it's really prime time right now. And you get them the hole on the stalk and you got to clean them up really well.
Sure.
But,
once you cut them off. Once you cut them off the stalk, wash them obviously very well, remove any outer leaves that you don't like, then take a small paring knife and just cut a little X in the bottom of them. That helps them to cook evenly. And then you're just going to blanch them in salted water. And at this point, cool them down and shock them in ice water and put them in the refrigerator. And then when you're getting close to Thanksgiving dinner time, you can put them in a gratin dish with butter, salt, maybe a little bit of lightly sautéed garlic, and just pop it in the oven. And that way, that will heat up beautifully for you. And a little Reggiano cheese wouldn't be bad either.
Yeah, a little Reggiano is good on there, or sometimes I will cheat and use a little bit of soy.
Oh, okay. Sounds good.
On the Brussels sprouts.
Sounds good.
So what else? Sweet potatoes. I have to have sweet potatoes.
One of my very favorite.
So is it yams, sweet potatoes, Japanese sweet potatoes, what the white sweet potatoes? What do you like the best?
Well, I really love white sweet potatoes. And again, we get those locally. But really, that may not be available to everyone. So any kind of sweet potato that you like. But if you are using the sort of peach-fleshed sweet potato, I like to boil them in water with a little bit of cinnamon and sugar and salt and just kind of cook them maybe 3/4 of the way and then drain them. And then again, right when you're getting ready to heat up things for Thanksgiving, I like to mix butter, brown sugar, Gosling's Black Seal rum, and again, a pinch of salt in there, maybe a tiny bit of pepper, and cinnamon. It's just so beautiful. And just coat the potatoes in that. Again, put it in one of your casserole dishes or a gratin dish, and you can get
them. How much rum? How boozy are these sweet potatoes?
That's up to you, but I would say probably if you're feeding,
how relaxed
let's say
do
you're
you
feeding
want your Thanksgiving
10,
yeah. to be.
Yeah. It's not flamed either. You could flame it if you don't want the alcohol in there, if you're concerned about that in any way. You could flame the alcohol before you added it to the butter. You know, I would say probably about 4 ounces of rum for perhaps sweet potatoes for 10 people, you know, let's say 10 sweet potatoes, 4 ounces of rum.
So this is kind of a casserole of like rough mash or gratin dish of
exactly.
rough mashed.
Oh, they're so good.
Potatoes.
And it smells so good. That's one of my favorite.
Do you brown them at all? Or
no, I don't actually. I don't. But you could. You certainly could. Yeah. But I don't. And then I really want to talk about potato puree.
I know you do, but I want collard greens.
Oh, all right, collard greens. So the thing that I've started to do, I've been making collard greens ever since we opened Georgia Brown in Washington, D.C., and I've gone through many stages with the way that I cook my greens, but always the foundation is smoked ham hock broth. And I now do a double smoked ham hock broth.
A
double one. So it's kind of like making a double consommé. We make it with, you know, let's say 10 people again. I would say 10 smoked ham hocks is fair. Please make sure they're smoked.
A ham hock per person?
Yes. And then, yeah, that's why I say double.
Serious.
Because I don't want you to have to make the stock twice. I want it to be as smoky as it can be and bake it, porky as
it
can be.
That's going to require a large vessel.
It is going to require a large vessel. So, you probably want to have water about 6 inches above the level of the hocks. And this one's easy. You simply put the water on the hocks. Again, that should be cold water. A rough dice of carrot, celery, and onion. You know, probably for 10 hocks, I'd probably do 2 carrots, 1 onion, and maybe 2 stalks of celery. And again, I would throw peppercorns in and maybe 2 bay leaves and just okay, this you're going to cook for like 6 hours. I mean, seriously, you just want to cook it, and get every bit of flavor
This is a reasonable thing to make that stock the day ahead also, then.
Exactly.
This is a good...
I would make the greens the day ahead. There's so many things you can do the day ahead. I mean, I think...
have to do that day are finish that breast and make those potatoes you keep wanting to describe.
Right. Exactly. And you'll probably never let me describe them, but people will be left out there wondering, how do I make those potatoes?
Right.
But really, the greens, you could even make 2 days ahead. That's the cool thing about collard greens. They just get better the longer they sit in that broth. I mean, obviously, you don't want to do it too far in advance, but certainly at least 2 days out is okay. So you make your broth. Again, you strain that when it's done. I don't remove the fat. I absolutely leave the fat in there, but that's up to you. And then it's time to cook the greens. We put a little bit of Tabasco in when we cook the greens. I think that acidic nature and spice nature of the Tabasco is super important. And,
there's a vinegar base to it. It's going to break down the greens a little bit, too.
Right, right. And so put your broth back on, add your Tabasco, and do not season it with any salt at this point, because those hocks have a ton of salt in the preserving process, and you don't want to overdo your salt. So I wait to salt them at the end if I think I need it at all. And so I pull the ribs out of the greens. I think that's a big deal. I actually pull the entire rib out of the green. I really don't like that part.
The leaves are rough enough.
Exactly. And also, you want to wash your greens very, very well. And when you're picking collard greens, you want to pick the smallest ones you can find. The smaller, the better. I mean, I've seen collard greens.
So pretty young. Like, if you can find them the size of your hand.
Exactly. And those
that's
are
terrific.
Those are ideal.
That's terrific.
And hopefully you can get local greens.
And double the size of your hand is fine. But once they're the size of like a big palm fan from the tropics, that's too big.
That's too big. No tropical palm.
The reason I love the greens so much is because think about it. Everything else is rich and fatty and sweet, and these are bitter and smoky and strong, and they set everything off. You know, it is the balancing point of the entire meal.
Well,
for
and
me.
Turkey goes so well with the taste
well,
of
the
all that.
The confit,
oh,
the confit
so
leg.
Together.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, all right. Okay, you have 45 seconds to tell me all about, no, just go ahead with the potato puree.
The big thing with potato puree is cooking your potatoes in the jackets. That way they don't absorb too much water.
What kind of potatoes are your favorite for this?
I actually like fingerling potatoes, but everybody out there will probably be like, really, are you kidding me? Because once you go to peel those fingerling potatoes, it is a pain and it takes a long
favorite?
Time. Yukon Golds. So there's nothing wrong with making potato puree from Yukon Golds. I mean, we do it all the time when we're making big batches of something. You want your water to be highly salted. Cook your potatoes until they're just soft. Then remove the skins. If you're like, there's no way I'm going to cook those potatoes in the skins and have to peel them, by hand, then go ahead and peel them first, but just make sure you don't let them absorb too much water. Obviously, we all know what water tastes like. We don't want the potato to change its texture too much, and we don't want them to become watered down in flavor. So once they're soft all the way through, get them out of there, dry them in a 350-degree oven on a sheet pan for, maybe 4 or 5 minutes. Just let them steam a bit, let some of that moisture come out, and then rice them. My mother always makes her mashed potatoes in a mixer. I have to say, I really, really, really prefer them done through a ricer, which is, it's not a machine. They're not that expensive to buy. You can probably find them in a lot of different places, and just go ahead and rice your potatoes.
You get the best texture.
Mm-hmm. And then the part that really makes them fine is putting them in a double boiler. So that means the riced potato goes into a mixing bowl or some sort of thing that you can put over a pot that has water in the bottom. That water should be hot on low heat, and you have your potatoes in the bowl on top. You have cold, excellent butter that you just stir in.
Unsalted butter.
Unsalted butter. Cold, you're actually emulsifying the butter into the potatoes, and you're adding hot cream, if you will, if you're like, there's no way I'm doing cream. Milk is okay, half and half is okay, but really, the best potatoes in the world are made with excellent butter, excellent potatoes, and excellent cream.
Make them super rich.
Yeah, and it's seasoned with salt and pepper.
And don't eat too much of them.
Right? Well, Joel Robichaud, there's a reason why he's one of the best chefs in the world.
And he became famous.
And he became famous for his potato puree.
His number one famous thing. It's kind of crazy.
It is crazy. So there is an art to it.
All right, when we come back on Take 5, we're going to get into maybe everyone's favorite part of Thanksgiving, sweets and wine. Welcome back to Take 5. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're chopping it up about Thanksgiving today, and I completely forgot to ask you about everyone besides me's favorite side dish, stuffing.
Mm.
Usually it's this like wet, bready substance that's very dull, and everything else has more flavor.
Well, not in my family. I don't know. I don't know about
So what do you make? What's your favorite?
I love three different kinds of stuffing. So my mother used to make a very... Oh, yes, I do. And I would make three, so that's me. But my mother made a very simple stuffing, sauteed onion and celery and butter with salt and pepper, and then she would use white bread, and she would just dry it out the day before and add it. I actually do that same stuffing, but I add pecans to it, and it's just ridiculously good. Now, if you don't want to cube white bread, you could use panko. Which I do sometimes as well. So panko, that's kind of
panko
nice.
Panko are those like dry Japanese breadcrumbs.
Right. And it's kind of nice because then you don't have that one more step of cutting the bread into cubes. The other one is I love cornbread stuffing, which I would tell you right now, if you do feel like making cornbread stuffing, you know, you dice your cornbread. I always add lemon juice to mine. I usually put some sort of tasso ham in with mine. And again, onion, celery. You could do bacon if you wanted to instead of the tasso ham.
There's
or you could skip
no
meat
butter.
Altogether and a whole
no
lot
butter.
Of butter.
So that's the spa cuisine version.
And yes, there's no spa cuisine going on at Thanksgiving in my house. And then the other is oyster stuffing, which I started making a few years ago and absolutely love. And it's just a process.
You already have the oysters, right?
Exactly. One more time, right? So you can use them again. And, you know, it's just the process of sauteing the oysters and a little bit of butter with salt and pepper and adding them to a simple stuffing like the first one I described. Mm-hmm. So that's how I make it. I'm sure there are a million ways to make all these stuffings, but that's what we do. So
now I know old school is to actually stuff it inside of the bird, but that's not that safe, is it?
That's what they say. I mean, in my family, we've been doing it since I can ever remember. So that's up to you. I've never had a problem with it. And, you know, I think it's just it's up to the way you cook it and handle the bird.
And how long you cook it.
Exactly. How long you cook it. And, you know, did you wash the cavity out? And where did you get the bird? And there's just a lot of things to think about.
What's the internal temperature? I mean, that's...
Right. Well, you want 160 degrees. So
yeah, if you're past that... You're safe with your stuff.
Right. And, well, I'm not going to say anybody's safe, but, you know, you have to do all the other things right. And, but, I mean, if you feel you do have the sanitation and the good bird, go ahead and do it. Because there's nothing like the flavor of that stuffing that comes out of the bird. It's just so delicious because, of course, all the juices from the bird are going into it.
Yeah.
So it's just really like nothing else. But if you don't want to fool with it, just go ahead and do it in a casserole dish. And, I mean, any of the stuffings I described would be delicious coming out of a casserole dish. Yeah.
So what do you want to drink? Because
well,
I know you need a glass of wine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm thinking, you know, Chardonnay. What do you think about Chardonnay with
I think people do that,
that
sometimes. And I think that the reason that people think of Chardonnay for Thanksgiving dinner as a grape or white Burgundy, you know, Chassagne Monoché, something like that, is because you think, oh, the turkey breast, you know, white meat, lean, white wine. It's a rich one. It's nice this time of the year, you know. My struggle with that usually is that unless I'm only going to eat turkey breast, and I'd rather eat the leg, especially if you confit it the way that you said.
Absolutely.
And I like the more full-flavored sort of side dishes. Most things either have some vinegar, or they're smoky, or they're a little sweet, or they're a little tart, or they're pretty salty. And all those things want something with more acid, maybe a fruitier character, and that vanilla flavor that comes from oak barrels that a lot of times Chardonnay is aged in. It's not real attractive to have, like, smoky collard greens and, you know, vanilla pudding.
Okay, got it. Right. Well, that makes sense.
You know?
Yeah.
But if your sweet potatoes are there and they're a little bit sweet, there's wines from Alsace I like in particular, that northeastern part of France right on the Rhine River. There are several different grapes. The one that at Thanksgiving I think that's the big crowd pleaser is Pinot Gris. Mm. Yes, that is the same grape that is Pinot Grigio in good and super mediocre forms in the northeast of Italy. But that in Alsace, from a good producer, you have rich, almost like smoky, natural, without being an oak, because there's very, very few producers that use new oak barrels. You have rich, almost smoky apple skin kind of character. Relatively similar density to Chardonnay, but without the wood tannin, with better acidity, and a little bit of residual sugar, which actually is super helpful with a lot of those dishes talking about.
The refreshing aspect of it just sounds so good because, again, we all know how heavy this meal is going to be. So anything that's refreshing is going to be a really positive thing.
But, you know, Pinot Gris or if you want something finer, brighter, more minerally, more, you know, one of the Cru Vineyard Rieslings that is done from a producer that does dry Rieslings, like Sipmach, like Weinbach, you know, those are producers that do beautiful things that are a little more high-toned. They still have surprising power. Like you taste it, you think it's delicate, but because of the intensity, the acidity, and the actual density of the tightly knit phenolic material, it will clean up big, rich dishes.
Sounds really, really great.
If for reds, to me, there are two great places to go for value for Thanksgiving. If you have a big crowd, one is Beaujolais. Beaujolais Nouveau has just been released. And if you have a relatively, you know, sort of a neophyte crowd and they want something tasty and juicy and easy, Beaujolais Nouveau that's chilled a little bit with Thanksgiving, all you know, sort of zesty and bright and fruity.
Perfect.
Fantastic.
Okay.
A little more serious. The Cru Beaujolais, some of the great age-worthy things, and you've got great vintages, 9, 10, 11, for Cru Beaujolais. And Cru Beaujolais, they're all named for the villages that they come from. So like Morgan, Brugy, Saint-Amour, you know, Chirouble. If you go to a good merchant, they'll have some of these on the shelves. And they can be very interesting, maybe more because they have a little bit of tannin to them, that sort of chalky business you get in your mouth when you have some reds. They'll do better with leg meat than they will with the breast meat. But you have a rich enough meal to handle that, no problem.
Well, it would be nice to have both things going, quite frankly.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, yeah, I mean,
has
you want things
tastes.
You want things open. You want
right.
white, you want red.
Right.
The other place that I think is super exciting right now in just in the wine world in general and happens to match up for Thanksgiving really well are some of the wines from Puglia, mm-hmm. all the way in the southeast of Italy. Puglia is Apulia, A-P-U-L-I-A in English. In this area, all the way down like in the heel of the boots, there are a couple of different vineyard sites where one of the original grapes that came and became known as Zinfandel in California is Primitivo. There are two versions of Primitivo, and there's another grape called Susamignello that is actually grown in California and called Zinfandel. There are some producers down there, like Menhir in particular. Who for not a big piece of money make, you know, what you think of is quintessential Zinfandel, which what it was maybe 25 years ago, juicy, spicy, rich, fruity, exactly what works for red and white, not super tannic, very easy to drink, something you want a little bit cool,
mm-hmm.
you know, sell at temperature, so 55, 60 degrees, but not a big piece of money.
And how do you spell the name of that?
Primitivo?
You said Menhir.
Menhir.
M-E-N-H-I-R. Very good. Okay.
Super producer. I think just starting to come into the U.S.
Yeah, that sounds.
But those are the things that I immediately think of. For you, you can think of, you know, like maybe you love great Cabernet Sauvignon. Maybe you should pick another meal.
That's because fine. We don't have to have Cabernet. Right.
But I mean, but
let's have what's right for the food. That's
well,
what it's
I mean,
all
the,
about.
The thing is, it's kind of like music and dancing, you know. The wine that actually works with the food. You may love country music, but if you have a ballerina in your house, you know, that's
right.
not what you play if she's going to perform, right? So
that's right. Right. We need things to pair together well. That's what makes sense. And it's nice that you suggest something that goes from different price ranges too, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's spend the money on the champagne to open, and you don't have to spend a fortune. Alsace wines, you know, are not super expensive. That for age-worthy whites, they're probably the best value in the wine world, period.
There you go.
If you want to get a little jazzier, find a nice bottle of Châteauneuf du Pape.
Definitely.
And serve it a little cool. You need a style that's not like Mourvèdre-driven, but that's Grenache-driven, more sort of red fruit-driven as far as the makeup of its grapes. But that's, you know, rich, soft fruit and juicy and spicy. And that will that's if you want a treat red for Thanksgiving, I think that's a pretty terrific one to do.
Yeah. And you have all this glassware probably that has some people might have things that were in their family for years and generations. And it's just so great to pull out, you know, special china and get your tablecloths out. And maybe if you have silver. So it would be wonderful to have wine on the table and get to use some of these things that perhaps we don't see very often throughout
Absolutely.
The year. You know, we're all
Absolutely.
So busy. We don't have time for things like that all the time. So,
you know, you mentioned cider in the beginning. You have kids coming, for goodness
mm-hmm.
sake. I mean, there's so many orchards in Maryland and Pennsylvania that make great cider. I got pear cider last week from Black Rock Orchard.
Very
that
nice.
Was fabulous.
Well,
I mean, if you have little kids coming, for goodness sake, you know, go to the farmers markets and get good fresh cider.
And the Honeycrisp cider is so good. Oh, we love to make sorbet with that too. That would be fun if you felt like doing something like that. It might be fun to make Honeycrisp apple sorbet for the kids.
Also for the kids, some of the big 48-year-old kids like me like dessert.
Yes.
So
I know.
So, Cindy, a favorite from down south?
I love Huguenot Torte, and it utilizes both pecans and apples, which is perfect for this time of the year. And what you do, and it's quite simple to make. So it's 4 large eggs, and you put them in the mixer until they're very, very fluffy, so probably 5 minutes on high. 3 cups of sugar, 3 teaspoons of flour, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 apple. And you want to use something tart, peeled and chopped into a small dice.
So like a Granny Smith or a Pink Lady or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And 2 cups of pecan, finely chopped, and 2 2 teaspoons of vanilla. So basically, once you whip those eggs into oblivion, kind of, then you just fold everything else in. It's so easy to make.
That is easy. So it's kind of like
awesome.
A fluffy egg, sweetened
it's so good.
Apple.
Well, it actually is
goo.
Almost meringue-like in texture. And you just put it in an 8x12 baking dish and bake it at 325, about 45 minutes. You do want to see a little color on top. It's so good. And then all you have to do is just whip some cream with a little bit of sugar and maybe, again, a tiny bit of cinnamon in it.
All you have to do is open a bottle of really good sweet Madeira.
There you go.
Like a mom's
Yerbois. So good.
And have that with a nice wedge of that.
That would be great.
That's a pretty nice way to finish. Pumpkin pie I need to have. Your pastry chef, Ashley Roop, makes fabulous pumpkin pie.
She does.
And so we're going to put a copy of her recipe up on WYPR's page.
We are, so you can try it yourself.
Absolutely. Just a quick word about Madeira. Is probably, if you're going to have a little bit of sweet wine, you know, like buy one bottle a year, buy a bottle of like 5-year, 10-year, 15-year Malmsey Madeira or Boal Madeira. It will not go bad. You open it, you pour a couple little glasses at Thanksgiving. Mm. You can do the same thing at Christmas time. It's the wine's already cooked. It's preserved. It really, the temperature doesn't make a giant difference to it. That's about as safe an investment as you're going to get in dessert wine ever.
It smells so good.
And it's not crazy. It's not a crazy piece of money.
And it
smells like
Madeira.
A pastry shop.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so southern, too. But yeah, and it just smells so good when you're drinking it. Or I don't actually drink it that often, but I cook with it all the time because I think it's an amazingly beautiful thing.
I also find it useful for drinking.
That's what it's for.
So for questions in the future for Cindy and I on Take 5. You want to send them to formanwolf@wypr.org. That's formanwolf@wypr.org for questions in the future for Take 5. And Cindy, any words of advice for Thanksgiving?
No, just enjoy it. Don't let the cooking stress you out. Do as much in advance as you can. That'll take pressure off of you because in the end, we all want to be around our family and friends and just enjoy a beautiful day together. So.
See, and I thought you were going to say make your guests do the dishes so you can sit and drink wine.
Well, that's a good idea.
Anyway, thanks very much for listening to Take 5. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. Happy Thanksgiving.